Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 2, delivered on August 23, 2018. The title of this lecture is Finance Concepts. Today, Introduction to Finance. To start off, we look at the screens. Almost every time we're together, we're going to look at the screens and watch these twitching, flashing videos that distract from why professionals might want to actually come here. Is this a good day or a bad day on the street? Down day, you see it. The reds, percentages, those are those significant or insignificant down? Relatively weak. It's nothing exciting. Truly went on. Now I'm going to look at the SPDR, which is the Standard & Poor's 500. It's a proxy of the Standard & Poor's 500. On balance volume for the day versus the 52-week average, was this a high trading day or a low trading day? Talk to me.
Me?
Yes. High trading or low trading day?
Low trading.
Fairly low. It's below the 52-week average, but then again, that's what I've been seeing over and over, this quiet. Some of the heavies are staying out of the action for at least the most part. They're in there doing portfolio control, but it's just not really all that impressive what's going on in the market these days. It's like waiting for the next shoe to drop. When is this all going to end? Now, if we were to look at the trading with the Standard & Poor's 500 stocks, this is an aggregate of the 500. Take me through the day. I want you to take me through this day all at once. And I want you to tell me, I want you, sir, walk me through the day from the opening bell. No, you. Yes. With the Justin Bieber hair flip, yeah. Okay.
It went up, and then it went down.
Oh, you're good. Really? Okay, let's try that again. You, madam. Yeah, you.
Stay within.
Start with the opening bell. At the opening bell, who was in charge? No, you don't need to read it. Just look at the chart. You can see it in the chart. The bulls were in charge. They came out of the gates roaring. And then they started. You just wish you could moo like that, you know. Anyway. You say mid-morning. Yeah, that looks like about 11, an hour before lunch. They collected lunch bull meat, and then through the rest of the day, there was a minor rally of the bulls in the going into the lunch hour, but it's pretty much it was flopping from there until near the end. What happened near the end? About 3:30, that looks like.
Yeah. The bears hunted again, and it ended lower than it did around.
That's good. You see there at the end, in the last hour of trading, the bears made a very strong push. You see that push the bears made right here with that volume spike? They pushed the stock prices down. And then the bulls This was bargain hunters. Stock prices were down, and so some of the bulls said, well, these stock prices are pretty low. Let's go in here. And you saw some heavy strikes right in here, right at the closing, right toward the closing bell. The bulls grabbed a hold of this, and they bought back in and shoved the bears back a little bit. But nevertheless, you see that at the closing bell, we were down from the opening bell. And that is what that would have said right there. We were down just basically 38 cents on the average, about 0.13%, which isn't anything impressive. So from here to here was a 0.13% drop, which is almost insignificant. But it was still not any kind of a spectacular day either way. Bulls and bears had some big fights and arguments and things like that. But at the same time, volume was weak. These were marginal players, and it wasn't anything that we should write home about or read anything into. In other words, it looked like there was some good news early on, but then, I mean, it was just nothing that's a major play. Now, if we go back, we see that all of the major indices were down. Nothing really spectacular, but there was a slight malaise, a slight negativity to the market today. But it's nothing that you could read anything really into at this point. Again, we are just floating right now. So that's how that's a read of a stock market. Now, moving that push forward, look at an individual stock. And we're going to look at a couple here, and I'm going to have you talk to me about what we are seeing. Caterpillar. Caterpillar, of course, most of you know that it is based just to the west of Bloomington. They have been a very strong force in hiring people from here. We've always had a little bit of a problem. This is called the Caterpillar Auditorium. They paid for this. They want us to bring them interns and employees. The problem they're a little bit annoyed with us because they are internship. They want you to not take classes for a whole semester and be an intern. Of course, that puts you back a semester graduating. But they say, oh, that's okay. It's such an incredible experience, and we'll probably hire you. And I've had a lot of my grads in finance, especially, and in management hired by Caterpillar. However, it has fallen on hard times. But for now, Caterpillar, was this a strong day or a weak day, ma'am, for Caterpillar? Was this a good day or a bad day? It was a bad day, and it was kind of a significant bad day. You see that 2.03% negative? That's enough to get your attention, to get your notice. Now, is this a risky stock or not a risky stock? Would you call this a defensive stock or an aggressive stock? It is an aggressive as hell stock. How do I know that? Why am I saying that's a very aggressive stock, madam? Why do I say that?
Because it has a high percentage that it went down.
Nope, there's a number there that you've got to find that tells me the story right off the bat. It's beta. Look at the beta. Beta tells us that this is an extraordinarily risky stock. Beta measures the risk of a security in a well-diversified portfolio. Beta measures the risk of a security in a well-diversified portfolio relative to the market as a whole. A beta of 1 is a stock that, if you had it in a portfolio, it would have exactly the same volatility as the world portfolio. A beta of 1 would mean that stock in a well-diversified portfolio would swing exactly like the market does. A beta of zero is a completely riskless security in a well-diversified portfolio. A good example of it would be a treasury bill. There's no risk in a treasury bill. You buy it, you'll get your money. So this one, what that beta is telling us is that this stock has 100, in a well-diversified portfolio. I don't talk about individual stocks. That's irresponsible as hell to talk about individual stocks on their own. You should never buy individual stocks unless you really want to get your ass kicked. In this case, this stock, Caterpillar, in a well-diversified portfolio would have 157% of the volatility of the world market itself. In other words, this is a bucking bronco of a stock. It whips more than 150% as strongly as the market. It's sort of like when you were young, did you ever get into a wading pool and you just kind of floated there? Okay, now imagine that suddenly I was a real fat kid. Hey, and I jump in. And you ride the tsunami, and it takes you out of the pool, down the sidewalk, and you get hit by a car out in the street. There you go, right there, 157%. Okay? This one is volatile. It's risky. This would be a stock that would be you would take if you were a high-risk investor. Now, we look at investors, and we talk very strongly about appropriateness of investment. In other words, we want to know, first we have to read you. Are you risk averse or are you risk taking? That's very important for us. Are you kind of like risk neutral? Now, I really worry when you talk too much about risk neutrality. Very few people are risk neutral, realistically. But what we do know is appropriateness of investment. How risky are you? And then we also look, where are you in your life? We would expect to create portfolios with betas. In other words, the portfolio will have the weighted average of the betas of the pieces of it, of the stocks in it or the bonds. So we would say, all right, younger people should have higher betas. And as you get older, you would want to bring down the beta. Because with higher risk comes higher expected return. With lower risk, there's lower expected return. So in other words, when you're young, you're going to want to make your killings, and if you get your clock clean, well, you have time to come back. Because for every win you might expect, if it's a big win, you should also expect to sometimes take a big loss. When you're young, you can bounce back. And then as people get older, you're going to have children someday. Maybe. You will have children, and that means that you're going to have to become a more responsible investor. You won't be able to take as many risks. You will be, at some point, you're going to start getting old. And that's a terrible thing. You get diabetes, you get fat, you get nodules on your neck. And I'm talking from experience here, by the way. And we want you're going to want more of a defensive portfolio that delivers income, not capital gains. And I'm going to talk more about that here in a minute. Now, knowing that, madam, what kind of a beta woman are you? No, I'm talking to you. Yeah. What kind of a beta person are you? Beta of 0.2, 0.8, 1, 1.5. So in other words, you are a risk-averse investor. You are a low-risk investor. Sir, what about you?
1.2.
You are a higher risk. You're willing to take a little more risk, about 20% more risk than the market, in order to possibly make 20% more than the market. What about you? What's your beta? One. How about you, sir? The thing is, it's interesting to us that when I taught a course like this 35 years ago, almost everyone would have been laying out betas of 1.2 to 2.5. We have found that over the last two generations, especially with the millennials, the average willingness to bear risk has fallen dramatically. It's just how it is. The new generations are more risk-averse than they were even 20 years ago, 10 years ago. And I've been seeing it. Every class I ask this, and you'll see, I mean, I used to never hear betas below 1. Now I hear betas below 1, and if they're above 1, they're almost always still pretty close, hugging pretty close to that market volatility. Now, the interesting thing is that with older people, we expect them to call betas. Once we teach them what beta is, we expect them to call betas that are low. And they do. But then we look at their investment portfolio that they've been building on their own or through their pension plans, and we are breathless. We see betas 1.2, 1.5. They don't know it, but they are actually behaving as high-risk investors, even though they claim that they're low-risk investors. It's kind of odd that way. And we point out to them, well, you're in very risky stocks for a person who doesn't want a whole lot of risk. And they'll just kind of like say, yeah, so what does that mean? Well, it means that you can make a lot more money, but you can also get your clock cleaned and you're 60 years old. You don't have time to come back from a loss in the market that can happen with a high-risk beta portfolio. The next thing that I want to show you here, now notice, by the way, the P.E. ratio, and I talked about this last time. Do you recall the P.E. ratio discussion? It used to be P.E. ratio is also a measure of risk. It's more informal, and always beta is your primary metric of risk. But P.E. ratio is also in play here. So with Caterpillar, we see, okay, it used to be, I would say, a P.E. ratio of 15 is scary. Now, I mean, you'll see P.E. ratios of 50, 60, and no one bats an eye. I still hold to about a 30 as being the sort of the fulcrum between low and high risk. In this case, that PE ratio, essentially it's price to earnings. Earnings are what belong to the shareholders after all the bills have been paid in their timely manner. So the price to earnings is essentially the market's assessment of how many dollars the market is willing to pay for $1 of current earnings. Put another way, the P.E. ratio says the market has determined that every dollar the company has made that belongs to the shareholders, that every dollar the company has made that belongs to the shareholders, the company will turn into $26.43 for every dollar the company has made. In the case of Caterpillar, for every dollar the company has made that belongs to the shareholders, Caterpillar is going to turn that into $26.43 that belongs to the shareholders. Now, if you think about it that way, that's kind of dramatic. Every dollar, the market thinks that every dollar is going to be, Caterpillar will turn into $26.43. Now, that anymore is actually, I used to say, oh my God, now that's actually a low risk. I mean, there, back in the heyday, back in the crazies of the late 1990s, you had P.E. ratios. There was a company on the Nikkei index that had a P.E. ratio of 200,000. In other words, investors believed that every dollar the company made for its shareholders would be turned into $200,000. Of course, it didn't work out. The company basically turned into dust. But let me show you another company here. So now in this case, you're getting sort of a little mixed information. The beta is saying this is seriously high risk, but that P.E. ratio is saying, well, the market's still not willing to pay a whole lot of money for every dollar of earnings. So there's kind of a lower risk, but always, always beta is the one you look at in the final analysis. Now let me show you another company, Netflix, NFLX. NFLX. Do you see anything unusual about Netflix? First of all, is this a high risk or a low risk stock, ma'am? Is this a high risk or low risk? Look at the beta. Look at the beta. Right up here. It's somewhat high risk. Look at the PE ratio. Do you see it? Yeah. 153.96. Really? In other words, investors think that every dollar that Netflix makes for them now, Netflix will turn into $154.
Man, they must have a plan for the best low-budget movies.
I'll tell you what, and as far as, you know that Netflix and chill? I've watched everything that's interesting.
That's what they're investing in.
I mean, I go for, you know, more of the movies, you know, scary movies, demonic possessions.
You know. Oh,
of course it does. I mean, I will not watch Stranger Things. A bunch of creepy-ass kids. No. Father Brown Murder Mysteries. Now, those were great. And that tells you how exciting my nights are. Fortunately, my cats don't care. They sleep. Okay, so, but the bottom line here is that Netflix is a high risk. Now, I want you to notice another difference between Caterpillar and Netflix. Go back to Cat. Caterpillar pays its stockholders a $3.44 per share dividend every year. Well, that's what it's going to pay next. That is a darn nice dividend. It's about 2.5% of the price. See, if you take the dividend divided by the price, it's essentially, now dividends aren't guaranteed. A company doesn't have to pay a dividend. But if it keeps paying a dividend, that makes Wall Street happy. And in this case, you kind of have a good idea that, if nothing else, you're going to make a 2.48% return on your $136.79 investment. It's sort of like putting your money in a bank account that has some risk, but at the same time, that's better than you can get in a checking account or a savings account right now. And anything else, the stock price going up, that's gravy. Okay, see that number? Forward dividend and yield. Now let's go back on Netflix. Survey says, what kind of a dividend do they pay? Nothing. Their plowback ratio is 1.0. In other words, their dividend ratio is zero. They take every penny that they make at the bottom line that belongs to shareholders, and they send it back in. And it's worse than that, though, because they're borrowing tons of money, too. Netflix, notice that's one of the things that can make a company very risky, is if you don't get a dividend, all you're going to get is capital gain. That's the only thing you can hope for. In other words, stock price rising. Now, theoretically, as a company's plowback ratio goes up, that should make the stock price go up because it's growing the company. That doesn't always happen. Look at this company right here. I'm going to show you another one. Target. Now, there's an interesting backstory, and I'll show you that one here in just a minute. But I can tell you right now, Target, its dividend ratio is about 48%. In other words, its plowback is only 52%. Target gives its shareholders almost half of what it makes for them and uses the other half to grow the company. Now, that's a very high dividend ratio. And that's for a company like that. But notice, is that a risky company or a not risky company, Target? Yeah, you see it, low risk. I'm beginning to shape this ability you have that most people, almost fewer than 1% of people know how to read a stock screen and see basic information about a company. In this case, this Target is actually a very low risk company. And that's because they give a lot of it back to the shareholders instead of reinvesting, which is a riskier way to play. So, and how do I know that plowback ratio? It's not that hard, and I keep sneaking this in on you, and I'll formally introduce it later. Let's have a look at the SEC.gov, and let's find the filings for Target. Company filing search, TGT. Look at their latest 10K, which is the annual Really? Did I miss it? Nope, I want the K. The Q is the quarterly. Interactive data, financial statements. Let's look at their statement of operations. If I look down here, I want to find the earnings per share. It's $5.33. The dividend per share is $2.46. So in other words, just a quick back of the envelope calculation, I would say that $2.46 divided by total earnings per share of, I'm just testing you, $2.46 divided by net earnings per share, and I'm going to look at from continuing net earnings, $5.33, 5.33. 46%, I was a little off on that. In other words, their dividend ratio is 46%. And then I'd say, okay, posneg plus one. So their plowback ratio, which would be the other part of the 100% of the earnings, is 53, 54%. That's why this is a low-risk stock. Target gives most of its money back to the shareholders and lets them worry about reinvesting it instead of taking the risk of reinvesting it itself. That will not mean, that means, though, that Target could be a stock that doesn't go up in price very much. So let's check on that and see what's going on there. Target. 1 year projection says that it will actually fall in price. You see that trade-off? More of a dividend, less of a capital gain. So there you go. It's kind of an interesting thing there. Target's a classic that I like to use for this example because you can see, well, you get a lot of dividend because you get a lot of the earnings. But when you get a company giving you all of its candy, it don't got no candy to reinvest. And so in this case, the market right now, there's a projection. Now, these are estimates. For all I know, this could be some cat or some dog making this estimate. But it's still pretty clear that this is a low-risk stock, low risk, low expected return. Now, I talked about this. Where's Cat? That's Netflix. Good grief. Now, right now, what I'm going to do is I'm first of all going to start with Caterpillar. Caterpillar, the projection is that the stock price is going to go from $136.79 in 1 year to $166.05. So in other words, if I wanted to talk about the total yield, the first thing I would do, I would say that that has two pieces. There's the capital gain yield, and then there is the dividend yield. These are the two ways that you can make money off a security, especially a stock, a common stock. The price going up, and you sell it at a higher price than you bought it. Now, here's a rule, by the way. You might want to write this one down. Okay. Buy low, sell high.
Damn it.
I know, right?
I've been doing it wrong.
I know. I tried it the other way, and I thought, you know, I'm a radical. I have no idea why it didn't work. So in this case, what we would say is, and here's how you calculate a capital gain. Now, this is a limited version of a broader formula. And I sneak it in on you this way, and then later, see, right now, this is convenient because this is exactly 1 year. So I've got automatic annualized for this. So the capital gain is, gains are always the end value over the beginning value minus one. That's how you do it. Now, this would give you a total gain. Now, if this were not perfectly a year end to begin, beginning to end, you would have to use an exponent here, one over the number of years. But because this is exactly 1 year, 1/1 is going to be nothing to worry about. So in this case, the projection is $166.05 at the end of the investment period, divided by $136.79 at the beginning, minus 1. And then times 100 to get it to a percent. Times 100 to get it to a percent. So if I did that for this stock, 166, whoops, 0.05, that's how much you would sell it for in a year, divided by how much you bought it for right now, 136.79, minus 1, 21.39% gain times 100. That's a hell of a gain right there. I mean, but there's more, because the dividend yield would be the dividend divided by the price, $3.44 divided by $136.79. But they calculate that for me, and I'm a lazy person. I'll just use their number. I trust that they did 3.44 divided by 136.79 correctly. So that's a 2.48% gravy. And that original one, what was that other one, 21.38%? Was that it?
0.39,
okay. So your total 1 year investment return, your return on buying Caterpillar, expected return, I should qualify that. This is not what you're going to get. This is what you expect would be, and I have to add the 2.48%, 23.87%. That's a hell of a gain. That's a hell of a yield, total investment yield. I mean, a world portfolio right now, probably, I mean, the estimates are all over the place. 2 years ago, the expected return to the market portfolio, beta equals 1. Would have probably, I was saying it was about 16%. Right now, with us teetering on the verge of a major market apocalypse, I'm saying it's about 8-9% now. But I mean, that's a hell of a return on this guy. Now, this is only in a well-diversified portfolio. You would need to put this with other stocks to control the risk of it. But in this case, Why is this return so high? What tells you that it should be a high expected return? Is there anything there on that screen that tells you this should be a high expected return? Do you see anything on that screen, ma'am, that tells you that it should be a high expected return? You got anything there on the screen that says, well, of course it should be? There, bingo. Good. I want to stop you before you say anything wrong. Yeah, it's a beta. That's a high-risk stock. Of course it's going to be a high expected return. You're not going to take a high risk unless you expect to get something out of it. I mean, you don't take risks in this world unless you are going to get something for that, or you think you are. Money, credibility, death that is noble. Watch Jackass movies. You ever seen the YouTube videos? No one is, those guys, they eat the hot sauces. Yeah. No one is, they're not making money, but they are getting credit, they're getting something of value. You wouldn't eat that kind of sauce. I did once. It was awful. I went to Calido Chili Traders at the Mall of America. They had a, their, I said, I want to try your hottest sauce. They let you sample. It was called Death by Stupidity. You want to talk about truth in advertising? My God. You know, I was hallucinating about my face melting off. People were rude. They were using their videos on their smartphones as I writhed on the floor and my skull was sticking out saying, God, it's hot in here. You take risk because you expect return. You're not going to buy this stock because you loved yourself Caterpillar. You're going to buy this if you expect a high return and you're willing to accept the fact that you could also get your butt beaten by it. That's why you do it. And that takes us to a very important investment rule. Investment should be blind to sentiment. Well, blind to sentiment. Well, I buy this stock because I work there and I believe in my company. Never do that. Well, I buy this stock because they're green and they love mommy Earth. God, don't do that. Well, I buy this stock because the CEO said disrespectful things about that crazy mofo in the White House. Don't! You buy it based upon the objectives of your investment goals. That's all you do. You don't buy stocks because you like it or your friends say it's a good idea or some moron on TV says to buy it. Well, this is a good investment. Well, you are on TV. Why aren't you out there investing in this? You're so hard up that you can't win in the investment world, so you are on TV pretending you can. It's all entertainment, those finance shows are. People believe those things. They believe Duck Dynasty, Honey Boo Boo. They believe those things. I mean, not that I watched Honey Boo Boo. I mean, Mom was hot, but, you know. No, she wasn't. Wow. Oh, damn. Okay. But you see, there's the problem is that we are trying to be told invest because of entertainment instead of investing as if your future depended upon it. That's what you have to do, and that's what I'm going to teach you, is take that sentiment out. Caterpillar, I wouldn't buy this stock because it's nearby or because they give you jobs or because I believe in the company. I buy it if it fits my investment goals, period. And this one does. Now, let's go over here. Let's look at this interesting little SOB right here. Netflix. NFLX. Do you notice that whatever you're going to make on this stock, it's going to be capital gain because it doesn't pay a dividend, so the second leg of the total yield isn't there? So everything about this stock has to do with the capital gain because you got nothing else that's going to happen with this stock, just the price going up. Now, if I were to crank on this one very quickly, just to do the same thing I did over there, I'd have the end value, 377, whoops, 377. Really? Is there some reason this sucks? Oh, this is that keyboard that doesn't, the numbers don't work. 377.50 divided by 339.17. See that? The ending value over the beginning value. And this is 1 year, so it will be a perfectly annualized return, minus one. Well, there's your Uncle Bob. 11.3% capital gain expected. Total gain, too, because there isn't any dividend. So that second part, there's no... it's just plus zero. Notice also, interestingly enough, that this fits the profile. The beta is still high, so it's above what I'm thinking the expected return to the market portfolio is probably around 8% right now. And that's going to be an important number for some of the modeling we do later in what's called the capital asset pricing model. But for the time being, think about the world portfolio. If you held like the Standard & Poor's 500 and some extra portfolio to really make it broad across the world, you would probably be wearing about an 8% expected return. Notice that Netflix is above the beta of one, and it is yielding, expected yield anyway, is a little above what the world portfolio was expected to yield. And notice that it is not as risky as Cat, And so we are not going to get as much of an expected return. That's that relationship. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. You're stepping into a world of risk when you do something like Caterpillar, 1.57 beta. So you expect that thing to really perform for you. Netflix, well, it's still risky, but it's not as risky as Cat, so you're not going to expect as much out of a stock like that over the next year. So you're seeing these broad principles of finance actually living in the markets, and that's what I want you to do. There's math and theory in this, but this is real world. This is where you make your fortune or you eat cat food in your old age. And so you're at that point where you can be more informed than almost anyone you know just because you had the greatest professor on earth. You also had me as a professor too, I'm sure. But you follow it? Yeah, go.
Yeah, does that number fluctuate a lot?
Oh, God. Well, it moves. Now, if there is dramatic information that no one saw coming, you can see that thing pop, boing, boing, boing. But overall, it moves more like a semi-solid fluid. That number that I'm doing there, from day to day, it's probably not going to move. That expected capital gain on Netflix is probably not going to swing a whole lot. But over a period of weeks or months, as more news comes in, it might show some friskiness. It might move rather surprisingly. Examples of that are when companies make announcements no one saw coming. Tesla. Actually, it kind of shocked everyone. You know Tesla, that company with the electric cars. They also have a division with electric generators, motors, and things like that. Now, the head of Tesla, who is the big, Elon Musk, he announced that he wanted to take the company private. In other words, he wanted to buy every outside shareholder's stock and make it his private company so no one would bitch at him about how much of a failure things are so far. I shouldn't say that. TSLA, I'm still hoping you'll call me for some consulting work. He said, I'm going to buy the stock back at $425 a share. Really? You see why that, well, okay, Elon, now once you come down from that crack cocaine, we can talk. Really? You're going to buy? And so if we look back, I think that happened earlier this month. Let's look to the year to date. The market said, holy shiite. And then they realized, oh, that's just Elon, and he's mentally ill. That was the first one. And then, and he's going to get in trouble for playing this game. He claimed, and there's very little evidence that it was someone besides him, but this rumor started in the market that the Saudis were going to buy it and take it private at $425. And of course, the market says, well, spank me Jesus. Popped it again. And then, of course, it turned out that the Arabs, the Saudis were more or less, we didn't say anything like that. And, okay, well, down it goes again. So you can see there's a roller coaster. Information comes in, we digest it. At first, we react instantly. And then over a period of time, we then begin to assess it on a deeper level. This is in the book, this discussion of market at any given time price versus intrinsic value. Eventually, the markets will figure out. It's like anything. Eventually, the markets will react to the immediacy of information. But over a period of time, they'll figure out the real story. So that intrinsic value, you've got to be careful about that, but still, go, talk.
How can it be so crazy and have a pretty low beta?
Because everyone knows that it's actually, you take away the cray-cray, and there's just basically a car company in there. That's all, really, and that's just that thing I was talking about. That sex appeal, that marketing, the news media, hyping. Look at what the underlying thing is. It's a freaking car company. And I'm really glad you asked that, because you caught, this is actually a fairly low-risk stock. Yeah, they're going to make cars. Eventually, they'll make cars that people actually buy. Unlike companies like, go ahead. Because it's a negative earnings per share. We don't calculate PE on companies that have no earnings per share. Yeah, it's basically, okay, let's figure out how high in the air we are standing in this hole. That's basically what it is. I'm glad you brought that up. This is actually a good story, is that, first of all, you won't see the PE ratio for a company like this because it's negative. We just say, by definition, we don't calculate. Now, the textbook says go ahead and calculate it anyway. Price divided, in other words, in this case, you would do 320 divided by negative 16.14. But realistically, no one besides that author of the first part of this book would do that. We just say it's negative. There's no dividend. There's no plan for a dividend. And think about it this way. The truth will eventually find its way through. Not in the short run, but the markets have to live in the short run. We can't wait for the long run. It's like sort of like this. Madam, you in the hat. You have this new neighbor come in. He's very nice, you know, well-dressed, really friendly guy. Your immediate assessment is, oh, this is a very nice man, and I'm glad he's my neighbor. It's only over the next couple of years that late at night you look and you see him getting into his car, and he's dressed like a clown. And then he looks at you one night holding a balloon. Yeah. That's, you found out over a long period of time, his horrible, horrible secret. He's a clown at children's parties. Wow.
In the middle of the night?
Yes. I mean, these are insomniac kids. You know, they play games, and you got to give them something else to do late at night. Yeah. And no, no. I mean, look. Yeah, it is. No, it's a broad market. I mean, where the hell was I? Okay. This was more like 1 o'clock. And what's worse, there were midgets involved too. I hate midgets. I had midgets come in here and kick me once for saying that I hated them in a class. Anyway, let's go. Let's move on here. Facebook. Face crook. It's still a darling of Wall Street, but this is not intrinsic value. Wall Street has a very strong incentive to support the price of Facebook in the face of the fact that this is a very seriously not particularly risky company. It's basically just a marketing company. You are the product, and it sells its access to you to advertisers. If you aren't the beneficiary, you are the product. If you aren't the diner at the table, then you are the meat on the table. And you are, it's got a vast global network. However, the market is clearly still kind of, the big dogs on Wall Street are still supporting this company, despite the fact that it is run by an idiot. It doesn't really have a whole lot of companies that are interested in selling stuff to you, but they still hold it up. It doesn't even pay a dividend. So you'd have to take that into account. That are we looking at something moving toward intrinsic value, or are we looking at the fad of the day, of the playground of the moment? So in this case, yeah, okay. So these are the kinds of stories that we talk about. And this is what I want you. I I do want you to be able to do the math, and obviously this is math, but you've got to look beyond numbers. Really? Sell Microsoft. Go short. Did you see that? The hell? Apparently.
I'll show this guy to you.
Apparently he did too. Okay, I could do the rest of this because I want to tell you about finance itself, what the story of finance is. I have no illusions about turning all of you to the dark side or to finance. But I can tell you what we do and where the jobs are and where they are not. Take away some of the perceptions. First of all, if it is a corporation where the liabilities are separated from the owners, there will be a board of directors that is elected by the shareholders, the board of directors. If you own a share of stock in my company, you get to have a vote for each of the people on the board of directors. Now, I might send you a little card saying, sign your vote over to me. That's called a proxy. But you can come to the shareholder meeting and vote your share. Now, some companies actually have two classes of common stock. They have one class that's supermajority, 10 votes per share. That's oftentimes with these companies that were started by some family and they want to keep control of it by having Class A Ford, Class B Ford. You don't get to have the one. Berkshire Hathaway. There's a Class A Berkshire Hathaway and there's a Class B Berkshire Hathaway. You can actually buy the Class A. I think the current price is around $250,000 per share. But so, you know, check under the seat of your car and see if you got change. But anyway, but the board of directors, they represent the interests of the shareholders. Their goal is singular, to maximize the welfare, the wealth of the stockholders, period. They are not there for any other purpose than to maximize the wealth of the stockholders. They are not there for the stakeholders. You will hear that in a lot of business courses. It's all political correctness. We have to say it so we don't ruffle feathers. Now, you know me. I don't like to ruffle feathers either. Like hell I don't. You're not there. Those board of directors, they are not there for the community. They're not there unless you're going to make a buck off saying you're there for the community. You're not there for the employees unless you can say we care about our employees and people are sucker enough to buy your product for saying that. We're not there for Mother Earth. Mommy Earth can take care of her own ass. We are there to maximize the wealth of the shareholders. You know why? What if you maximize the welfare of, let's say, the community instead of the welfare of your shareholders? Who fires you? Does the community or the stockholders? You got it. They are. When the question, there's this big, deep philosophical question that is often asked. Who's your daddy? You find out that your daddy is the shareholders. If you don't do what they want, they will spank you. In a loving sort of way, of course, yeah. But anyway. So then the board of directors hires the management team. The executive management starts with the chief executive officer, the big dog. He is hired by the board of directors. He oversees the entire thing. Now, in my time, I met real CEOs. Now, I'm a CEO. I'm Alan Kring, CEO and president of Emergent Light Studio, Inc., well, la-di-da. But I mean, I've met the real CEOs. The ones who are good at what they do, they have this vast mind. They can see an entire organization from one end to the other. I'm talking about these multinational companies. They see the whole thing. They don't hand off problems. They take care of problems. They don't suffer agency. Those kinds of CEOs, they don't want candy up front. You hire me, but you give me some stock. No, you hire me, and if I do well, then you give me stock options. So if the stock price goes up, then I make money. Or you give me a percent of profits. They aren't the kind that want candy before they've shown performance. And I've met some that are absolute idiots. But I've also met some that are pretty, just vastly knowledgeable. I mean, when you've got a company that's got like 600 different outlets in 18 countries, and it has shipping and transportation interests, IT interests, all that kind of stuff, and they can see it all in their minds, that's, you have to have years and years to get there. Now, the CEO drops down. Now, this part, I used to do two prongs. There was, on the one hand, the chief financial officer, and on the other, there was the chief operating officer. The COO handled all the production different threads down from him. The CFO, on one side, are the accountants, and on the other side is treasury, or something that's called like that. There's one in the middle now. Really, I started showing this one only about 5 years ago. It just didn't exist. Does anyone know what the third leg of the executive management team below the CEO is? Not CTO. CIO. CTO would show that they don't understand what they're doing. Chief Information Officer. It is so central. We have to have someone at the high rank of the executive, the senior executive management, because so many of our operations are dependent upon information flow. We also are dealing with a world of absolute jackasses who are trying to break into everything they can and just wreak havoc. They steal, but in a lot of cases, these are not, they don't even have an agenda. They are anarchists. They just want to destroy. We've got them from Eastern Europe, Russia, Pakistan, the Netherlands, places we don't even know, North Korea, even countries. Huh? Which one? Well, yeah, they're all over the place. The United States really doesn't have very good hackers. We have to catch the hackers overseas and then threaten to kill them. And then turn them. Then we get good ones, the good ones. Anonymous is an ass organization. They used to be everyone's hero. No, they're a bunch of thieves and scoundrels and dog beaters and nose pickers. But anyway, we've got to deal with this. It is like the viruses, it's like our bodies are finally understanding that they have to build massive defenses against this stuff. Because we're all in a computer age. And if you think I know computers, I mean, I'm good. But some of these cats, I mean, it's just like, I'm pretty sure they're just androids or something like that, robots. Okay, now, this is sort of out the layout of finance. The other part, though, is, well, what is finance? What can I do in finance? Most people, when they think of finance, they actually think of one of the dying areas of finance. Investments. This is buying and selling stocks and bonds. This is actually disappearing. Artificial intelligence systems, they're not even AIs yet. But there's so much like artificial intelligence that you can't tell the difference. True AI is still about 5 years away. It's getting frightening how close. We've seen the hints of AI, real AI, in the last 6 months. But even with these pseudo AIs, they are so good that they can do stock and bond trading so much better than people can. My students in this finance club wanted to see a real brokerage house. And I took them to a boutique house up in suburban Chicago. Boutique is a house, it has a limited clientele, but the clientele are filthy rich. So they went into this, and they were expecting to see this big trading room with all these traders calling on the phones for clients. There was just one giant obese guy just sitting there. He was playing Candy Crush. And he looked like Jabba the Hutt. I thought, you know, where's Leah? And the thing was, though, they were saying, okay, well, what kind of trading do you do? How do you make your decisions? He said, I don't make decisions. I have the artificial intelligence system and the financial engineering software. Just tell me what to do. I don't even have to push buttons. I can tell it, you just do the trades. That's all there is to it anymore. Yeah. It ain't like it used to be. So if you come up to me and say, I am good at trading. I day trade. I buy and sell stocks by myself. Don't tell me that nonsense. You're not in the league with what these computers can do now. But there are still jobs and investments, but they are difficult to find. And the people who get them are generally going to bust their butts. You saw that movie Pursuit of Happiness? Remember Will Smith? He went through hell. That was an NASD Series 7 that I took, and he was in my era. The one that you guys would take is lots harder, and there is a lot more competition for a lot fewer jobs now in straight-up brokerage houses. I don't want to discourage you, but I don't want to make you see the world as it is not. Another area of finance, much, much more prospective now, is corporate finance. You work inside of a corporation. Now, the corporate, you are going to be the one who decides. You would be in a division where you decide whether a project is a go or a no-go. Generally speaking, there's a company here in town. It's quiet, very large company. And they divide up the corporate. They have the ones who do cash management. Money comes in, we figure out short-term investments until we have to pay it to someone, managing cash flow. And then the other side is for big projects, that's the capital side. We have to do the cap, we have people who know how to borrow money long term or sell stock, stuff like that. So that's one way it could be divided. But corporate finance, there are quite a few jobs. The one thing I hate about it is that, well, we want someone who is new, who is a starting level corporate finance person. Minimum job, minimum experience, 20 years. Yeah, you might have already seen that. Well, we want to hire new young people with 10 to 20 years of experience. Really? But anyway, more jobs here. Another one, insurance and risk management. This is a huge field right now because insurance companies, oh, we project over the next 5 to 7 years, 500,000 jobs. Because they hired all these people in the 60s and 70s, and then they stopped hiring. Those people are getting old, retiring, dying right there at their desks. And so we have one of the top schools in the nation right here, the Katie School of Insurance. And it's not, I'm not talking about insurance where you sell auto insurance to mom and daddy. I'm talking about commercial insurance, where you're setting up insurance policies for all of the different complexities of corporations. You have to find, you identify all of the risks, and then you find each insurance company that will cover that risk and put together a portfolio of insurance. Commercial brokering is heavy-duty stuff. And the insurance industry is pouring money in. We have an organization, an insurance club here called Gamma Iota Sigma. I mean, the insurance industry throws parties. They give grants. They send people on internships. There's a lot of money in there. Another one is institutional finance. This is banking. Banks, and there are many different kinds of banks. I would say that almost no one in this class knows that there is more than just the banks that you go to put your money in and have checks and debit cards. There are many different kinds of banks. Investment banks, commercial banks, private equity structures that are like banks, credit unions. Then you have real estate, and I'm not talking about selling mom and dad's house. I'm talking about shopping malls, skyscrapers, condo complexes. Commercial real estate is still very wide open. And then the last one, Entertainment finance. Entertainment finance. I'm not talking about streams of money or rivers of money or lakes of money. I'm talking about oceans and oceans of money. Music, movies, sports, you name it. That is the emerging field, and we are still not teaching much about that, but I will. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.